All right. Members of the committee will come to order. We're not at quorum yet, but we're going to get started. The game plan here, if you will, is to spend substantive time over the course of the next 2 days vetting through Representative Slocum's Charter School update reform bill. As many of you know, last year the legislative auditor issued a report on charter schools that was published, I think, halfway through our session, so we weren't able to respond quickly enough to some of the calls for reform in the auditor's report, but it certainly gave us an opportunity over the course of the interim to carefully consider the report and its recommendations. I then requested that Representative Slocum lead a working group of our committee to more carefully deliberate the report and to consider crafting legislation for this legislative session. And I don't know, I can't remember all the members of the committee. I think Representative Abler, you were a member. I think Representative Simon, Representative Erdahl, and Hornstein, and Representative Hornstein. So a lot of former members of this committee and a couple holdovers as well. The Senate then similarly created a working group led by Senator Saltzman, and both Representative Slocum and Senator Saltzman conducted joint public hearings. So I think they had at least three hearings, and then a series of meetings with legislators, among legislators, and with several stakeholders. Meanwhile, the department has also diligently been working on a bill in response to the auditor's report, and also actually last year in their policy bill, which we did pass out, and the governor fortunately vetoed over some other provisions. We had vetted through a number of related charter school reform issues. So all that by way of saying that there's been, I think, a sort of a head of steam that's been building around reforming some of our statutory expectations of this sector, including very proactive efforts on the part of the sector itself. And you'll hear shortly from them as well, as they've stepped up to lead and accept the need to do some important changes and better regulating the operations of charter schools. All that also by way of saying that I think there's a lot of consensus building, but obviously the devil's always in the details, and so our work over the next 2 days is to get into the details. We're going to start, however, by contextualizing all of this in terms of hearing from the legislative auditor. We've asked him to give us a presentation of last year's report, and so that'll give you some good, strong background of the kind of the big issues that are out there. They, of course, have a series of recommendations that they've offered as well. And then we'll have Representative Slocum come forward and present her bills. And then we'll begin to hear from interested stakeholders. We will not be moving anything today. If amendments are in order, it would be my request that you let me know. We don't have a 24-hour rule, but in fairness, so that folks understand, is that this is a complex issue. If you can let me know your if you have any amendments, hopefully tomorrow then we'll walk through. If there are, we'll walk through those amendments. And the goal then would be to move the bill out of here tomorrow's hearing. So with that, I see a question from Representative Abler. Before I call on you, we are at quorum, so I will officially convene us. And I'm sorry?
Oh, sorry.
And then Representative Abler, if you can move the February 24th minutes.
I'm sure they're great minutes. I'd be honored to move.
Wonderful. Representative Abler moves the minutes of February 24th. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Abler.
There's no free question, is there, Mr.
No. Exacted my pound of flesh.
There you go. Just for the process of it, I think you're on the right track with this. I think that we're going to come out with some good work at the end of the day on this. And the Senate's acting in a little different ways, which I think will be that can be accommodated when the dust all settles. But to that point, I hope that you just mentioned process, and I think it's great to send it out to finance, which is the traditional destination for a charter bill. But at least the parts that are absent money, if it's supposed to be put in the year policy omnibus, I just express my ongoing concern about the thoughtful nature of the end of session, and the most thoughtful way to treat our policy matters would be in a separate bill. So just to encourage you that one.
Very good advice.
So it could go both ways. I mean,
right.
In both bills.
Very good advice, Representative Abler. And as many of you know, as many of you will learn, it's often good to play out as many options as you have before you in terms of trying to get to the end game or to the end point of having successful legislation signed. With that, I am going to ask Ms. Randall to come forward and give us a presentation of the report of legislative auditor on charter schools. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judy Randall. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Excuse me. It's good to be back here today talking about charter schools. I'm going to start by just giving a brief overview. If that starts going. There we go. Minnesota was the first state to authorize charter schools, and it did so in 1991. The idea was to give families and students some more choices in their educational options. Charter schools operate outside of the traditional school district structure. So parents, teachers, community members, they come together and they develop a school that is separate from the existing school district structure. Charter schools are exempt from some education laws. They must comply with a number of the laws that apply to school districts, but they're exempt from some of the laws that apply to school districts, and in return for some of that flexibility, they're subject to some additional oversight by sponsors. And I'm sure you all will be talking a lot about sponsors over the next 2 days, so let me just kind of remind you what sponsors are. Sponsors do not financially support a charter school. In fact, typically charter schools pay a fee to the sponsors in return for some additional oversight. Sponsors authorize charter schools, and they also must monitor the academic and financial performance of a charter school. Let me just give you a brief overview of the numbers we're talking about. During the current school year, there are about over 32,000 charter school students. That's about 4% of the state's K-12 student population. And currently there are 153 charter schools that are located across the state. And here, the map is actually a year or two old, but I think the patterns generally hold. We've got about a third of the charter schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul, about a third in the Twin City metropolitan area, excluding the two inner cities, and then about a third in outstate Minnesota. So while they're concentrated in the seven-county metropolitan area, they really are spread across the state. So that was a quick overview, I know, but that was just to kind of get us through it. I'm going to jump into now our findings and recommendations regarding oversight and accountability. I think that's really the focus of the next 2 days' conversation. One of our big findings was that charter school oversight is unclear and really quite complicated. As I mentioned, each charter school has a sponsor, and the sponsor authorizes the charter school and then monitors the school's performance. So the Department of Education also has an oversight role of every charter school. And so this kind of dual oversight role is contributing to the complication and the lack of clarity in terms of who's in charge of what when. I know this seems like a really simple diagram, but we find that it's pretty useful in talking about the different roles. There at the bottom, you see the charter school, so that's the entity. And then just like every school district, there's a charter school board. And the board is elected by the teachers in the school and then the parents and the legal guardians of the students who attend the school. So the charter school board, just like in a school district, has direct oversight over the charter school. You also see that the Department of Education has a direct line of authority over the charter school and its board. And then the sponsors also have this direct line of authority over the charter school board and the charter school. So really what adds to the complication here is the relationship between the Department of Education and the sponsors. We've illustrated that here by this dashed or broken line, and that line, that dashed line, is kind of the focus of our findings and recommendations. Let me provide a little more information on who the sponsors are, and then we'll talk more about that overlap and duplication of these two, the roles of the department and sponsors. So, who are the sponsors? Last year, there were 53 sponsors, and who they can be is outlined in law. They have to be certain types of organizations. So, by law, a higher education institution can be a sponsor. So, for example, Hamline University is a charter school sponsor. Independent school districts can be sponsors. So, for example, the St. Paul School District is a sponsor. Intermediate school districts, which are cooperatives of independent school districts, can also be sponsors. Nonprofit organizations that meet certain asset requirements can also be sponsors. So, for example, Volunteers of America, Pillsbury United Communities, Friends of Ascension, those are all nonprofit organizations that sponsor charter schools. Not on this list are education districts, which are another form of kind of cooperative, collaborative districts. They are allowed by law to be sponsors, but at least through last year, none of those were choosing to be charter school sponsors. And then finally, the Department of Education sponsors charter schools through a grandfather clause, but they're not allowed to sponsor any new charter schools or take on any additional charter schools in the sponsorship role.
Ms. Randall, so we have 53 sponsors, we have 153 charter schools, so obviously sponsors are all, each sponsor can authorize more than one charter school. Does the report have information on the sort of quantifiable information on that, as well as how these would break down? Do we have like a preponderance of higher ed institutions sponsoring as opposed to nonprofits, or is there any of that in the report?
Mr. Chair, members, if you've got the report in front of you, on page 39, table 3.2 lays that out. And this is for the 2007-08 school year, so last year. And there you can see the different types of sponsors, the number of sponsors in each category. So if we just take the first line, the number of independent school districts, there were 21 school districts that acted as charter school sponsors last year. They collectively sponsored 35 charter schools, which was 24%. I will just kind of say the nonprofit organizations, they tend to sponsor more. You know, each nonprofit charter school sponsor tended to sponsor more than one, you know, more charter schools. And school districts and the intermediate school districts tended to sponsor fewer, so maybe just one. St. Paul sponsored more, but a lot of the school districts, especially outstate, are just sponsoring one charter school.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Norton has a question.
Thank you. In your opening comments, you mentioned that some of the charter schools, it sounds like, provide some financial support to their charter school sponsors. Can you tell me which of those or how many of those are getting funding for doing this?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair.
How much?
Mr. Chair, Representative. So there's in law, and the department and the sponsors will know this much more fluently than I will, but so sponsors don't provide funding to charter schools. Charter schools provide the funding back to the sponsors, and there's a formula in law, and it's, unfortunately, I've got the new bill in front of me and not the old bill, the old existing law. I don't know if Ms. Larson can, let me see if I can see what the deleted, okay, so.
And Ms. Randall, we could certainly circle back, Representative Norton, to this question as well, and if there are any questions that arise that are part of your ongoing, just feel free to say, I'm going to get to that, that's
okay.
Fine, because I certainly want to encourage, you know, a lot of ownership of knowledge here. But I also don't want us wandering all over the place without some kind of logic, and I think you're at least providing us a plan to go forward. But if that's information we can get to later, perhaps it's a great question, but perhaps we can hold that, Representative Norton, and make sure that we vet that through. But go ahead, Ms.
Mr. Chair, I do just have it right here in my fingers,
wonderful.
So I'll answer that one. Right now, the way it's in law, sponsors can assess a school, and I'm just going to read you the way the law is. In its first, second, or third year of operation, up to $30 per student, up to a maximum of $10,000. And then in its fourth or subsequent year of operation, up to $10 per student, up to a maximum of $3,500. And I will just add, I know of very few sponsors, and maybe in very special cases, that don't charge that fee, but most sponsors would say that that doesn't cover their costs. The sponsors that are very active in their oversight, and I'm going to be getting into how different sponsors provide different levels of oversight, those who are very active in their oversight and doing what we think is really laid out and expected in law, that doesn't really cover their expenses. But I don't have exact data on that right now at my fingertips, sir.
But I suspect we can get that data, Representative.
Certainly can.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Randall, just a quick question. Of the school districts that sponsor charter schools, how many sponsor charter schools outside the geographic limits of the sponsoring district?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I don't have an exact number for you. The department might have that. My guess based on the site visits and the surveys and all the research we did is very few. Most of them do it within their district.
Thank you.
That may be slightly different in our cities because of the densities and so the sort of the morphic sense of community. I know we have, I think we have some Minneapolis. I know in St. Paul we have charter schools that pull Minneapolis students primarily. Maybe that's a different question.
Mr. Chair, the piece I'm focusing on is I know of at least one situation where a school district over here,
pardon my reach,
sponsors a charter school over here.
Yeah.
And it strikes me, if a school district is interested in sponsoring a charter school and developing an innovative education strategy, can't they do it in their own district? It's an odd form of coaching. That I've always found.
You know what? I'll have Mr. Morgan answer that, but I'm going to pull us then back because I really want the auditor to get through their report. But these are great questions, and I don't want to say don't ask these questions. But you know, I also want to make sure that we get through this report, and then we obviously have all the stakeholders here. We can ask these questions. So, Mr. Morgan.
Mr. Chairman, members, I can answer this quickly. There is
Mr.
just one.
Mr. Brown, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I apologize. Morgan Brown
with the Department of Education. There is only one charter school in this situation. It's Skills for Tomorrow Charter School, which is located in St. Paul, and I believe sponsored by, I want to say, the Rockford School District, but we can check on that. But just to be clear, the law stipulates that, yes, a school board in one district can authorize or sponsor a charter school in another district, yes, but only with the written permission of the school board in that district where it's going to be located.
That. Okay. All right, Representative Dutsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Could you explain to me what an education district is? I haven't really heard of that term before.
Good question, Ms. Randall.
Sir, Mr. Chair, members, an education district seems to be very similar to an intermediate school district. It's a collaborative group of school districts that work together. And I also hadn't heard of that term before I stumbled upon it in the charter school law and had to kind of dig around and find a couple of them. And it really appeared to be very similar to an intermediate school district.
And I think they're prevalent in greater Minnesota than in the Twin Cities urban core. I believe that's right. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up with Morgan Brown. And would that include also the online charter schools? Because sometimes they're started in one district and they apply to many districts.
Mr. Brown, have you hopping up and down?
I'm Morgan Brown with the department. The situation with the online charter schools, which exists both under the charter school law and under the department's interpretation under the online learning statute, is just like any school district that wants to provide programs either full-time or part-time to students that don't reside within their geographical boundaries. They have to go through a separate state certification process under the online learning law to do that. So for a charter school, which doesn't have geographic boundaries, because they can serve essentially statewide, that is their boundaries, they have to go through the same process as those school districts. And currently we have 6 charter schools who do provide online learning in that way and have been certified under the law, and then we have 8 school districts and then 6 consortium of multiple school districts.
And they can be statewide?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, and they can be statewide?
Yes, under the department's interpretation, yes, they can, if they go through the separate process of being certified under the online learning law.
Mr. Brown, feel welcome to stay there if you like. I suspect there may be some, and actually I think it's helpful. I think there's a lot of of the sort of basic information questions that I think will arise, like the question of what an educational district is. And so feel free, or you can hop back and forth. Ms. Randall, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a reminder of what the sponsors do. They approve charter schools, so charter school can't be operating unless the sponsor has approved it. And then this is the language in law. Sponsors must monitor and evaluate the fiscal and student performance of the charter school they sponsor. As part of our evaluation, we visited 10 sponsors, so about 20% of the sponsors, and we visited 14 charter schools, so just shy of 10% of the charter schools at the time. And we sent a questionnaire to all charter schools and sponsors in the state. And based on the site visits and the questionnaires, we found that sponsors really vary in the amount of oversight they provide. Some sponsors are very involved in the oversight that they provide. They require monthly reporting, monthly financial reporting, monthly board minutes, regular reports of test scores. They regularly attend the charter school board meetings. They regularly visit the charter school. They're very hands-on and involved. Other sponsors have a more hands-off approach. Some of them only meet with their charter school once a year. One sponsor we visited met once a year with a charter school to receive a report that the charter school had prepared, and that was the extent of the oversight that they provided. As I mentioned, we met with a number of sponsors, and some of them said that they didn't really feel equipped to perform all of the duties that are outlined in law. One sponsor told us that he didn't feel he had the financial expertise to oversee the school's financial performance. One sponsor didn't know that her school had not made adequate yearly progress in the prior year. One sponsor said he wasn't really sure what the role of the sponsor is. So there's a lot of variation out there. Again, some are very involved, and I think some of them don't provide the level of oversight that is expected in the law.
Ms. Brando, I suspect this might get to some of your recommendations, but perhaps for Mr. Brown, is there a process in place with the department to provide some level of training and orientation and direction to sponsors?
Mr. Chairman, some of this is covered in the OLA report.
Mm-hmm.
Currently in law, the only requirement for a sponsor is to meet the minimum eligibility requirements that Ms. Randall referred to. And then, in addition, the department's done a number of things. Well, we do require sponsor liaisons to go through some required training, at least one. And then our approach has been, up to this point, to provide other types of training and resources, both written guidance and technical assistance sessions, to help authorizers. And I think the result we've found has been the authorizers that are the most engaged and serious about authorizing have taken part in that and benefited from that. But then we have a group of authorizers that haven't, frankly, been that engaged in authorizing, and they haven't availed themselves of that. And I think that the result of that is some of the OLA's recommendations.
I jumped ahead. Ms. Randall, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we think this variation in oversight is due in part to lack of oversight by the Department of Education and in part due to some unclear authority about what the department's role is over sponsors. So it boils down to what we found are some gaps regarding charter school oversight and then some duplication. And the gaps come to what we were talking about, Mr. Chair, is the sponsor demonstration of their abilities and oversight of the sponsors directly. So first point, which is what Mr. Brown was just talking about, is that the department does not approve a sponsor's overall ability to sponsor a charter school. So a sponsor doesn't need to apply to become a sponsor. If they've met the requirements outlined in law, then they're able to become a sponsor. Additionally, the department does not hold sponsors accountable to standards in any ongoing fashion. So here are the gaps we find, where there's not really oversight or accountability on part of the sponsors. But what we did find is some duplication regarding the charter school. The department approves all charter school applications, but this often duplicates what the sponsor does. So if I want to start up a charter school, I go out and I find a sponsor that's going to authorize my school. I then, especially if it's one of the sponsors that are really involved, I'm going to have to go through a pretty rigorous application process with that sponsor and demonstrate, you know, everything I need to do to become a charter school. Sponsor and I agree, yep, sponsor's going to approve me and authorize me. I then have to go apply to the Department of Education and go through a whole other rigorous charter school application approval process. So there's a lot of duplication there. It also leads to a lot of confusion about who's in charge of what, who's got authority over what, and it kind of just makes the whole thing more complicated and confusing in terms of, again, where the lines of authority are and where the lines of oversight are. So here are our recommendations regarding oversight. The first batch is to the legislature. So we recommend that the legislature clarify the role of sponsors in the department. We recommend that the legislature require the department to approve sponsors. And then once a sponsor's been approved, the sponsor has increased authority. So what we envision here is the department approving sponsors, and then the sponsors then approving charter schools. So we've got kind of a more streamlined line of oversight. Again, department over sponsors, sponsors over charter schools. Now, the department would still have some authority over the charter schools, just like they do for all public schools, regarding financial accountability and compliance with regulations. But the department would then get out of the role of kind of this approving process and also the academic monitoring process, and really give the sponsor, once the sponsor has demonstrated its ability, give the sponsor more authority to do that. Now, if the legislature gives the department and the sponsor these responsibilities, the department then would have some work to do here. The department would need to implement some standards for sponsors, provide training for the sponsors so that they can meet these standards, and then ensure the sponsors meet the standards on an ongoing basis. What we don't say directly in the report, but basically what it's getting at, is kind of an accreditation process for sponsors, where they would have to get approved and then kind of every 5 years or so demonstrate their ability and capacity and capability to fulfill the responsibilities outlined in law for sponsors. All right, so I'm going to move now from talking about oversight roles of the department and sponsors to now talking about the board, which is that other level of charter school oversight. And we found that the conflict of interest provisions for the charter school board are inadequate. There's two main points here. One, conflict of interest laws, the state conflict of interest laws for charter schools are weaker than the conflict of interest charter school laws that the federal government requires. And then also the conflict of interest laws for charter schools don't address potential conflicts of interest with sponsors. And it gets complicated really fast, so we put together this chart to walk everyone through it. So there's three sets of laws that apply to charter schools regarding conflicts of interest. The state charter school law, the federal charter school law, which applies when a charter school receives federal funds. This is typically in the first 3 years when they receive the startup grant, and it can be ongoing if they receive additional federal funding. And then the school district law is incorporated by reference into the charter school law regarding conflict of interest. So you've got these three sets of laws here. The first point here is if a charter school board member has a financial relationship with a for-profit organization that is providing services to the charter school. All three laws say, yeah, that's a conflict of interest and not okay. So again, a yes here means that they've identified that as a conflict of interest. So this is when a charter school board member has a financial relationship with a for-profit organization. Nobody allows that. If it's a non-profit organization, however, the state charter school law doesn't say that that's prohibited. They say those need to be disclosed to the department, but they're not totally prohibited. The other two laws say that's a conflict of interest and not allowed. The third point is if a charter school board member's immediate family member is providing contracted services to the charter school law. And in that case, only the federal charter school law says that that's a conflict of interest and it's not allowed. Both state laws don't address this issue. And then finally, none of the conflict of interest laws addressing charter schools address potential conflicts of interest with sponsors. And that would be when the sponsor is providing a service that's in addition to sponsoring a charter school. So, for example, if a sponsor leases a facility to a charter school, there could be a potential conflict of interest there. None of the laws address that. So, from this slide, three main points. First, you can see that the laws are at odds with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Second, you can see that the federal charter school law is the strongest, but again, only applies when the charter school is receiving federal funding. And then third, that none of the laws address potential conflicts of interest with sponsors.
Ms. Friend, I'm going to stop you there for a second. Representative Faulks has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question has kind of been answered, but not exactly. For nonprofit organizations, doesn't every school somehow get some federal money if they have special ed or something? Isn't every school actually getting either directly or indirectly some federal dollars? So. Isn't every school then a nonprofit that meets the Minnesota law, aren't they all violating the federal law then?
I have the same question, Ms. Randall. Or perhaps Mr. Moore, or Mr. Brown.
It's okay, I answered either. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The language regarding this is specifically referenced in the regulations for the federal charter school program, which is what has to do with the federal startup funding. Okay. But you're right that it is similar to regulations that appear in other places, not an identical language, for other types of federal funding. So I think the whole goal that we're going to talk about of the recommendation in the bill is to make it all consistent across the board. Because it really, I mean, yes, there may be a few charter schools that don't receive very little or no federal funding, but most, you're right, are going to receive it in some form with their Title I or special ed or anything.
Well, primarily referring to federal startup monies, which a number of charter schools, in fact, do access. Yeah. Representative Liu.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that was really follow on to my question, which how many of the 153 charter schools in Minnesota receive federal grants as part of their startup of their operations?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I'd have to get back to you with that figure. In the early years, it was not available because the federal law hadn't been passed, but since then, I would guess since Minnesota received its first grant in the mid to late 90s, virtually every charter school that opened also applied and received a federal grant under the grant we had from the federal. It would be very difficult for the charter school without that federal startup funding.
Ms. Randall.
But I might add that startup funding then doesn't last forever. So when that ended, if they weren't receiving other federal funds, then those charter school, the federal laws wouldn't apply then for the conflict of interest.
Very well. Ms. Randall.
So we have some recommendations regarding the conflict of interest issues, but before I get to them, I want to talk about one other issue with the board, which is the requirement that teachers comprise a majority of charter school board members, and we think this poses some problems. Minnesota is the only state that requires teachers to comprise a majority on charter school boards, and this really contradicts best practices for organizational governance. The Minnesota Council of Nonprofits recommends that no more than one staff person of an organization be on that organization's board. And we think that's a relevant benchmark or a relevant standard because charter schools have to incorporate either as a nonprofit or as a cooperative. Also, having a teacher majority leads to circular oversight. So during the day, you've got the director there. He or she's in charge of the school. And then at night, they go to the school board meeting, and then the teachers are in charge of the director. So there's a lot of a circular nature there in terms of who's in charge of what. And then finally, having this requirement makes it difficult for the schools to obtain the expertise they need to run their schools. And I think this is best illustrated by a site visit we did to a very small charter school. The charter school has five teachers. And by law, charter school boards have to have five members. So five members, three of them have to be teachers then based on this majority rule. All right, so this school has five teachers, one of whom is the director, so that person can't be on the board. So you've got four teachers left. Three of them have to be on the board, whether or not they want to be. And we heard from teachers who said they didn't want to be on the board or they were burned out. And then in addition to that, the school said, you know, these teachers may be great teachers, but they don't necessarily have the financial expertise, the legal expertise, the governance expertise that we need to run a board. So let me go to I do want to point out that there's a waiver process currently. So right now, the board has to be in place with the teacher majority by the third year of operation. The school can apply to the Department of Education for a waiver. And my numbers are a little old, but between January of 07 and June of 08, 14 charter schools applied for a waiver to the teacher majority requirement and were approved, and 15 charter schools applied for a waiver and were not approved. So you can see that charter schools are seeking some flexibility with this requirement, but they're not all getting it. So now let me move to our recommendations regarding the charter school board. First, we think the legislature should expand Minnesota's conflict of interest laws to match the federal requirements. The federal requirements are the strongest. That way, these requirements would apply all the time, whether or not they're receiving federal funding. We also think that the state's conflict of interest laws for charter schools should be expanded to address those potential conflicts of interest when the sponsor is providing services outside of the charter school contract. We're not saying that these arrangements should not be allowed, but we do think they should be entered into cautiously and disclosed to the department. We also recommend that the legislature removed the requirement that charter schools follow the school district conflict of interest law. Frankly, if you take the first recommendation and you expand it to the federal requirements, you won't need it. It will be duplicative. And secondly, having it in two places is confusing and makes it difficult to ensure compliance. And then finally, we recommend that the legislature remove the requirement to have a teacher majority, have teachers comprise the majority of the charter school board members. We made this recommendation in our 2003 report, and we're making it again this time. We're not saying that teachers can't be on the board and can't be a majority. We're simply saying it shouldn't be a requirement. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's the end of kind of the high-level stuff on oversight and accountability. I'd be happy to answer more questions. However you want to proceed.
Thank you, Ms. Randall. Let me ask you very quickly, just I think I heard you say this, so I want to make sure. On the second recommendation regarding conflicts of interest, expand Minnesota's conflict of interest law to address sponsor conflicts. Mm-hmm. You're not suggesting, I think I heard you say, you're not suggesting the level that of requirements relative to members that you're applying to members of the board. What you're asking for is some level of disclosure, some level of transparency in terms of any potential conflicts that can exist. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. So we're not saying that it absolutely can't happen, that a sponsor can't provide other services for to the charter school, but we do think they need to be disclosed and really entered into cautiously. I mean, there certainly are instances that we thought where it made sense for the charter school to provide whatever service, or sorry, for the sponsor to provide a certain service to the charter school. But there is a potential for that to unduly influence a charter school contract. You know, I mean, you could imagine a scenario where a sponsor would say, well, if you don't have us, not that we have any record of this happening, but the potential is there for a sponsor to say, if you don't lease your building from us, we're not going to renew your charter school contract. Now, again, we didn't see that, but the potential is there. So we just think this needs to be super above board and super transparent.
And the relationship between sponsors and members we've been using, I know a little bit, back and forth sponsor and authorizer, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we go through Representative Slocum's bill, but I think we've been using that interchangeably. Mm-hmm. And now I forgot the question I was going to ask. So we've got four members, and I'm going to move on to Representative Slocum's presentation, Representative Norton, and then Representative Fouts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was really pleased to see that you're dealing with some of the board issues here, and I have received contact from some community members of mine, some constituents who are charter school teachers and have worked in three different schools and have recommended this, so I know they'll be very pleased to see this change. There's another change that I've had calls about with regard to board members, and it's not with regard to teachers, but it's with regard to the fact that unlike public school boards, and I know charter schools are public schools, but of a different sort, the board members, it happens in one of our schools that not one board member, save the teachers, who were all brand new because it's a new charter school, so don't even know our community, they're all from outside, there was not a community member on the board. And there is no requirement in law that says that board members need to reside in, be parents of community members of the very community that the charter school is in. And that's a real issue for parents in this school who are seeing people from the Twin Cities who have not the ownership that a parent or a community member might have for the school making decisions about their children. And because of some religious elder conflicts, there's not an opportunity to speak out on these issues publicly. So I'm wondering if you have given any thought to this, if there could be an amendment put in that says that there's some requirement that someone from the community be on the board or something of that nature.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's an interesting point and a good point. I think part of the issue is defining the community of a charter school because, as Mr. Brown said, it doesn't have this, you know, obvious geographic boundary as opposed to, you know, St. Paul School District, it's the city of St. Paul. So I think defining the community might be an issue. And I think that, well, I do think that Representative Slocum's bill might in some ways address that concern. So that might be something that comes up. Yeah, so I think that might come up. I think it's a valid thing. We did not, you know, put that in as a recommendation. I think we were more concerned about making sure the skills needed to run an organization are there. But that doesn't invalidate your point, I think, that the community is important and should have some representation somehow. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question has to do with the standards that you've implemented or that you suggest being implemented for the sponsors. There's also some improvement for the board members as far as some training. But I didn't see anything as far as the standards or the quality of the education that the students are actually getting. And some other reports that I've seen, I think it might have been that one of the papers did, that some charter schools are doing a fantastic job. Others are not so good. And I'm just wondering if you would, you know, I didn't see anything of that on the report. You didn't report any of that. You know, did you see that? Did you get into that at all and you just didn't report it, or wasn't that part of the assignment you had? And if not, why not? Because I think that really is the most important thing, is are we getting the results out of these schools rather than if the board knows what they're doing or not. It's really, are the results there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's the part of the presentation that I didn't include today because of the focus on oversight, but I can do it real quickly. We did look at some of the charter school performance aspects, and I'll try and go quickly on it.
No, it's quite all right.
Okay. What we did is we wanted to, before I jump the gun there, we wanted to assess how charter schools were performing compared to district schools, That's how we distinguish in the public school. You know, they're both public schools, so charter
right.
schools and district schools is the terminology that we use. And so what we did is we used the MCA2 assessment data. And, you know, I think the first thing that's important to know is that there's some significant data limitations with the data. But we still felt that we could have some useful insights into performance, but we certainly wanted to recognize the data limitations. So here they are. We look at 1 year of assessment data. And, again, the MCA2 provides, you know, a snapshot of performance. So it's not going to show the growth of a student or, you know, how a school goes. Kind of a very blunt cut is that statewide charter schools didn't perform as well as district schools. And I'm going to just turn to my notes here. So, for example, if you just did a very blunt cut, and also I will say that Chapter 2 in our report explores this in more depth if you really want to get into the nitty-gritty. So when we looked at adequate yearly progress, which is the measure used by No Child Left Behind, 50% of charter schools made AYP in 2007, as opposed to two-thirds of district schools. Okay, so that's just a very blunt cut. But there's a lot of differences between charter schools and district schools, and one aspect of that is demographics. I'm just back up here to show you some differences in student demographics between charter schools and district schools. So here on the red bar are charter school students, the yellow bar is district school students. So you can see on the free and reduced price ones, you know, 53% of charter school students qualified for free or reduced price lunch as opposed to 30% of district schools. Minority students with similar types of differences. Limited English proficiency, 21% to 7%. Special ed is the only place where district schools had slightly more students in special ed than charter schools. So we wanted to capture those demographics and when we looked at our analysis. So now back to that one. So what we did is we tried to identify charter schools and district schools that were as similar as possible. So we did this on a couple of different dimensions. We broke out the charter schools by region. Minneapolis was one region. St. Paul was another region. The seven-county metro area was the third region, excluding the Twin Cities. And then outstate was our fourth region. We then identified charter schools. For each charter school, we identified the district schools in those regions that had comparable free and reduced lunch percentage of students and comparable minority students. And so looking at that, when we compared each charter school to its comparable group, that's what we called it, we found that kind of in general, charter schools still did not perform as well. So 15% of charter schools performed better on the math MCA2 than their comparable group, but 51% of charter schools performed worse on the math MCA2 than their comparable group. But it varied. I mean, as you said, some charter schools were doing really well and some charter schools weren't doing as well. Minneapolis and St. Paul charter schools were more likely to outperform their comparable schools than were other schools. But we also wanted to look at some additional factors. You know, we looked in the national literature, and there were some additional factors that affect student achievement, most notably mobility. Mobility seemed to come up a lot in the national research. So when we included mobility as a factor, in addition to region, free and reduced lunch status, and minorities, we found that the differences in performance between charter schools and school district students diminished significantly. Now, charter school students still didn't perform quite as well as district schools to their comparable group, but that difference really narrowed a lot when we took into account all those different factors. Again, region, free and reduced lunch rate, you know what I mean, minority rate, and mobility rate. So that's the quick and dirty on that. Again, there's more detail in Chapter 2.
And members, this is probably a topic that in of itself would merit deeper discussion. There's a whole host of issues that that I think, to some degree, Representative Newton and his colleagues are wrestling with in terms of integration issues. As I was looking at the free and reduced lunch, you know, it seemed to me, you know, an obvious question: are we creating a sector that allows us to concentrate poverty in schools? I think those are legitimate policy discussions. It is not, however, the nature of the Slocum bills. Her bills are the charge to the work group had to do with the running, the as you stated, the skills, to look at the skills needed to run charter schools and to address issues of oversight and accountability. But obviously, we all do this for the purpose of driving good educational outcomes. Mr. Barnes, please.
Two quick clarifying remarks. One is just a response to the representative's question. I didn't want the impression to be left that although there's flexibility and autonomy for charter schools, they do not have flexibility in terms of meeting state standards or having to comply with any of the statewide accountability requirements. So they receive AYP ratings and just like any other public school. In addition, they also have to meet the goals in their charter, and this is where authorizers come in, the importance of strengthening authorizers to hold them accountable to the academic goals in their charter contract that should be the basis for whether they get renewed or not. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they're accountable to parents because they're schools of choice. The other thing I wanted to quickly mention is because the department's position is there really hasn't been a study to date of charter school performance compared to district performance where you can infer a causal link between a student's performance in a charter school and the performance of the charter school overall, because none have been done with longitudinal data that follows the students. And this is particularly important in charter schools where we have students coming from other schools and coming to the charter school at various grades. So we've actually signed a shared data agreement last year with a very respected organization out of Stanford, which is going to do a multi-year longitudinal study of charter school performance compared to students who have similar demographics in district schools. So we'll be able to provide that to the legislature, hopefully next year.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. You anticipated my question. it's good to know that that's coming forward. All right, so we have four, and then we will move over to the Slocum bill. Representative Briner, Representative Depke, Representative Dabney, Representative Peterson. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Randall, this is regarding board constitution membership, and it really piggybacks on Representative Norton's question, and I don't want to belabor the point, but when you went through the structure of oversight, you said the charter school board paralleled the district school board. And, you know, you said it was elected by teachers and parents. Well, in a district school, board members are elected by the public. And I think it's a critical issue. These are public schools. What is the role of public oversight? You know, I think, the elected board, I mean, it's the taxpayer position in terms of oversight. It's directly connected to the operation of that school that's missing on the board of the charter school. And I think that's a critical difference, and I'm wondering if you gave that any consideration.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's an excellent point. That is a big difference between the charter school board and the district school board. I think it comes back to defining the community of the charter school. And absolutely, it's still taxpayer money. It's still a public school. So, you'd want the public to have a voice. I think the question is, again, it comes down to defining the community, I guess, because there isn't that geographic boundary. Again, the charter school does not have levy authority, you know, so they can't do the referendum. So that's another difference. And so while the district school board can do the levy on its residents, you know, the charter school board does not have that authority. So it has, it accesses the general revenue money, but not necessarily revenue directly from its geographic area.
Professor Breiter.
Just a quick follow-up. I do understand what you're saying about the pragmatic issue about who is the community, but I think that's a critical issue, a principle or philosophical issue about where is the public in the public charter school.
Representative Zepke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question going back to the conflicts of interest and number three, remove requirement that charter schools follow school district conflicts of interest laws. It's my understanding you said that you eliminated that one because of the fact that the conflict of interest laws would now match at the federal. Is that correct? Okay.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, if the legislature adopts the first recommendation, which is to expand the charter school, the state charter school conflict of interest laws to match the federal ones, then you no longer need to incorporate the school district one because it would be duplicative, and then have it in two places would be confusing.
Representative Dupke.
Just one quick follow-up question to Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown, when you do the review of the statewide charter school performance, are you going to be including in that, in the 15% of the schools that are doing well, are you going to include a best practices as well?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that will not be part of the organization we're dealing with. Is its specialty is in doing, looking at longitudinal data and tracking it, not necessarily in best practices, but I think an obvious next step would be for the department to look at that, or us to contract potentially with another entity that would look at, for those schools where we do see substantial growth in that study, to look at what do those schools have in common.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And actually on that point, Mr. Brown, it may be helpful for members of this committee to and for the department to find some kind of way to do some joint, if you will. I don't know what the process is going to be with Stanford, but to the degree that this committee is informed of both that process, and as data comes in and as you're analyzing it, the earlier it seems to me that we can do that, the better, as opposed to waiting for just a report to come to the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to do that. I'm guessing the people from Credo at Stanford would be happy to come testify and talk about what they've done in multiple other states in terms of this kind of study.
Thank you. Representative Dabney, and then Peterson, then we'll move on to Representative Slocum's presentation. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to narrow down my area's question, although there are several. Mr. Brown, can you contrast for us you mentioned several times the training that MDE provides, charter school boards offers. I think the OLA raised a concern there. The training that MDE offers charter school boards versus the training that they provide regular district boards?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, and this was addressed in the OLA report, so maybe I should defer to Ms. Randall, so she can talk about what the OLA's findings were on it.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, there's a couple points here. First of all, the department provides kind of offers training to charter school boards, but it's the same training that it offers to all board members, and so it's not necessarily tailored towards issues that charter schools might face, such as, you know, the starting up thing, or projecting enrollment, that's a big issue for charter schools, or cash flow management. So there's not as much targeting of issues that would be important for charter school board members to have. The other issue is charter school board members are not required to attend. Initially, when they're first starting up, that group is required to attend training. But then 5 years down the road, when a new board member gets elected, they're not required to attend the training. So the way the law is currently is the department's required to provide it, but the board members aren't required to attend it. And that's different than in a school district. A school district board member has to attend the training, I believe, within 180 days. So we do have a recommendation in the report, and let me get through it exactly on page.
And while you're looking for it, the bill that's before us also addresses that issue. And I think there's a stronger requirement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson's bill actually addresses all of the concerns that the legislative auditor raised, as well as their recommendations. So now charter school board members would be required to attend board training within a certain period of time. They would receive customized training. Now that we have a mass of charter school board members, they would receive training that was customized to the needs of charter school board members. And because what we've done currently is we've made available our broader board training, and then we provided on more of an individual basis customized training to boards that needed certain kinds of help. But this would respond to the concerns of the OLA.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, I think my concern is questioning the public purpose there. Is that training most appropriately delivered with taxpayer dollars, or shouldn't that be the responsibility of the Charter School Association to provide that, much as the MSBA provides training for school board members? And if MDE is providing the training, doesn't that then muddy the supervision and oversight function of MDE and create kind of somewhat of a conflict of interest? Why should the taxpayers be paying for it when, to best my knowledge, we're not paying for MSBA's training of board members?
I mean, the statute currently requires us to provide board training to charter school board members. So the recommendation built on the existing statute say, first of all, we want you to provide customized training, and we want board members to be required to attend it if you want to offer it. But one thing that Representative Slocum still makes clear is it says department approved training. So it isn't implying that the department would necessarily provide all the training. It may be the Charter School Association, or it may even be MSBA that wants to set up a program to provide the training, and all we're requiring is that the commissioner approve it to make sure it meets the conditions of the statute. So it doesn't mandate that the department be the one to provide all the training, although there would be some areas, like regarding around school district finances, where there might be an important role for our program finance division. But we're leaving that open in the law, in the bill.
I'll try to limit it down to one more question.
That's quite all right. They're great questions.
All right. Thank you. Well, then you get two.
That's the last poodle you get.
I believe it was the same deal you cut with Representative Abler on the minutes motion this morning. There was a reference to the charters being... The charters are time limited, that they have to be renewed every X period of time. And I think to my teaching license, where I have to demonstrate so many hours of continuing education, and there can be some very specific requirements about what sort of training I receive on recognizing emotional disturbances, if I remember correctly, and reading strategies. What are, and I guess this is for Mr. Brown, not Ms. Randall, what are the hoops? What are the requirements to get your charter reauthorized, and what's the timeline?
Right.
Mr. Herbert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney. Currently in the law, there's a 3-year timeline for the contract, and then it has to be renewed every 3 years. And one of the things there's not much in the statute on this process, although there will be more if Representative Slocum's bill is enacted. But a lot of the information we've given to authorizers on what are best practices for authorizers give information not only about that renewal at the end of 3 years, but we very strongly emphasize to them that their oversight shouldn't be, we kind of let the school go, and then when the 3-year renewal comes out, all of a sudden we do this major review. It should be an ongoing review process where there are targets and measures and reporting every year during that 3-year review process. So when it gets to the 3-year review, the authorizer already has a sense of the performance and whether they're going to renew the contract, rather than it all being passed into that 3rd year. I have information we could share about the publications and training we've given to authorizers to help them with that, but certainly under Representative Slocum's bill, which follows the OLA recommendations, authorizers would have to demonstrate that is part of their process up front, even be approved by the commissioner to authorize charter schools in the future.
Quick follow-up, and if I'm understanding, the charter is granted by the sponsor, not by MDE.
Right.
So these schools never have to come back to MDE and say, here's our performance academic, here's our performance fiscal, please renew our charter.
Mr. Chairman, representative, you mean after the initial authorization
for
the renewal process? Right. On the renewal process, that responsibility is left to the authorizer, which once again backs up the importance of the OLA recommendations in strengthening the whole process for the department's approval and oversight of authorizers.
Last question, I promise.
Mr.
Brown, on the study that's being done on charter school performance, is it being done on charter school performance or is it being done on charter school student performance? Because one of the issues we run into consistently in Minneapolis with the challenges on the data that from the state test is the student starts the year in a charter school, then they bounce to the Minneapolis schools and they're tested there, but the charter school, you know, was or was not doing a good job, but the kids are moving around, and the question that never gets asked by the data is who's responsible if little Jimmy is 2 years behind, if little Jimmy has been bouncing around from charter to private to traditional public and the like. So are you looking at charter schools or are you looking at the kids?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, without getting too technical about it, it really should be looking at charter school student performance in the sense that for the first time we'll be tracking individual students' performance over multiple years longitudinally. But because it does that, we'll be able, particularly now that it gets more complicated, obviously, when you have students with high mobility, but for students that stay in a charter school for 2 to 3 years, or for 2 to 4 years, or in a district school for 2 to 4 years, because it's longitudinal, we'll then be able to infer some causal link between the student performance and the school's impact, where with these one-year snapshot studies, it's impossible to do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Dabney. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I think Representative Dabney actually asked my question. I was a little concerned when you talked about the comparison of students and the mobility issue, because my next question would be, well, when the students left, where did they go? Back to the public school, to another private school? And that whole issue of not being able to track an individual student leaves me a little concerned about making that statement about the mobility and comparability then to public schools, and I did have concerns about that issue.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. I mean, I think mobility raises flags for everybody, and I could direct you to page 26 in our report. We show mobility rates by region and by charter school and district school, and we thought it was pretty astounding. Trying to see. So 23% of Minneapolis charter schools had a mobility rate of 100 or greater. I mean, it was just 100% mobility rate or higher, meaning that it doesn't mean that every student left, but it means that some of those students churned. Some of those students churned a lot. So it wasn't that, you know, if Mr. Brown and I were in a school that we both just left, I might have stayed the whole year, but Mr. Brown's seat might have turned over a lot. So I mean, I think mobility is really a big issue. It's extraordinarily high in charter schools. And it's, you know, the national research has linked it to performance. So I do think mobility poses a lot of problems. The study that the department has contracted for, you know, if they can get down to that student level and track that student in and out of charter schools and in and out of public schools, I think will be a big leap forward in terms of the state's understanding of student growth and learning.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess then I would, you know, think maybe a little bit differently than about comparing. Maybe take that out of the comparison realm, because I think it's pretty nebulous at this point to compare. I mean, I'm not sure how valid it is. Then when you compare the schools with their mobility rates in and out and the student achievement issue. But maybe there's some validity.
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, and what we did was we identified district schools that had comparable mobility rates to the charter schools. Because mobility is so linked to student performance, we wanted to somewhat control for that. Because if a charter school has lots of mobility and a district school doesn't, then we think that would set up an unfair comparison. So we wanted to try to control for that. So say, you know, within a plus or minus 10% range, you know, they're both having really high mobility. We wanted to kind of take that out of the equation to the extent we could. Again, it was a snapshot of data, so I mean, we're hopeful that the study, the forthcoming studies, will give us better and more information.
And Mr. Brown, so you're hearing, you know, some of the thought processes and the thought processes of the committee members here, and so again, I think that it'd be, in my mind, it'd be highly helpful and beneficial for the department and for legislative committees as you go through this important longitudinal study to have some early interactions with members here that can better inform and perhaps even collaboratively shape some of the finer details of whatever data is coming forward and perhaps even how that data is being collected. Not that Princeton doesn't know what they're doing or Stanford doesn't know what they're doing. Princeton doesn't know what they're doing. Stanford doesn't know what they're doing, but I just think that and you're hearing some real deep thoughts here about what would be helpful parameters for this body in terms of making some distinctions based on whatever data gets collected among different student groups. So all that is sort of an appeal for early engagement with the department. Very well. Ms. Randall, let me just ask you, I think you've had a chance to review. I know that Representative Slocum-Thrill, we're going to be moving House File 935. I know that it's gone through several iterations, some of them kind of last minute because stakeholders continue to meet. The department's been at the table as well. But if you had a chance to look at language, and can you give us your assessment of at least the latest language that you've been able to view, how that compares with the recommendations that the auditors are suggesting in the oversight and accountability realm? Are we way off? Are we close? Does it meet your recommendation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I went through the DE3 last night, and I know now it's delete all four, it looks like, but I kind of skimmed through it here. It's a moving target. I think it's right on. I think it addresses, at least in some fashion, all of the recommendations, I think it goes very far in addressing our concerns about the oversight and accountability. And, we have on page 61 in our report a list of our recommendations kind of in one spot. And so I went through that and kind of crosswalked it, and I've got check marks or okays next to all of them. So I think they've all been addressed, again, to some extent, in a favorable way.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And members, you probably all heard the president's speech last night. He referenced charter school as one of many things that administration wishes to focus on. We know that the Secretary of Education has a strong interest in evolving strong charter schools as part of our public school offering. All that by way of saying that I think it's really important that our existing charter school framework in our state be in fact the most effective framework and most accountable framework possible, because I don't anticipate us moving away from this sector anytime soon. That's sort of a not so hidden appeal on the part of the chair, that obviously this area can call forth for all sorts of issues here that would go beyond the oversight and accountability goals that I think Representative Slocum and the working group both in the House and the Senate have focused on. And I just don't want us to lose sight of that. Obviously, as legislators, we can offer all sorts of amendments and ideas on charter school legislation. But I hope at the end of this session, anyway, that we not lose the important goal of making sure that our existing laws and our existing guidance in terms of charter school oversight and accountability mechanisms, that those be strengthened. So that's just my little appeal. Ms. Randall, thank you very much. For your presentation, and Mr. Brown, I guess you can stay there because you're part of the next presentation. Representative Slocum, The chair moves that House File 935 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a re-referral to the K-12 Finance Committee. So the bill is before us officially. We're obviously not going to get too deep into your bill because we'll be adjourning in a little under 15 minutes. We will continue this discussion at the next committee hearing on Thursday and need be into next week as well. So don't feel like you need to rush to get to the end in 14 minutes. I trust that Mr. Piccolo and Mr. Baum will be available tomorrow morning to continue the presentation of the report. Representative Slocum, the chair then would move the H.O. 935 DE4 amendment, and I believe this amendment basically puts the bill in the order that you wish to have it before it. So members, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is before us in the form in which you and stakeholders and the department, I believe, wish it to be before. So, Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Charter Public School Reform Bill. It was a bipartisan effort, completely. When Chair Mariani asked me to chair a work group on charter schools, I was rather delighted. I'm a traditional public school teacher, not very traditional actually, but in a traditional school. I'm a union member. I'm a member of Education Minnesota. I'm a union steward in my building, just as background. However, I also support choice in education fully and completely. Kids are not, they don't come to us cookie cutter, and I have found working within a traditional district that change is often hard to come by, which is why I like the concept of charter schools, and I have from their inception 17 years ago. They're with us. They are a part of our public school system. They offer some innovation. They offer different ways of dealing with kids, and I think that they should be supported. I was delighted to do this because I'd like to see charters strengthened, the areas where they aren't, where the headlines come into play. I think we need to shore them up. We need to make them accountable, and we need to make them the roles within the charter schools very clear. And that's what this bill does. We studied the auditor's report at length and drafted legislation from it. I think it's a very good bill. I want to personally thank Representative Simon, Abler, Udall, and Hornstein for their participation, and they were great. We had public hearings. We had stakeholders testifying. We listened to a lot of testimony. It was interesting. We looked at all different perspectives, and we heard a full spectrum of comments and read a full spectrum of reports and opinions. And this is what we came up with. I would like to introduce, well, you know, Assistant Commissioner Morgan Brown, and this is the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, Eugene Piccolo, and they're going to help me explain this bill. The bill represents a lot of compromise from everyone. I even have stuff, there are things in this bill that if you ask me, I'll tell you, that address some concerns that Education Minnesota has. So, trying to make everybody pleased.
Well, and ultimately, Representative Slocum, the goal is to have very good public policy. So
it is. Thank you for working awfully hard
and working on this. You were trying to shepherd this through its tail end while you were battling with some pretty tough cold
pneumonia. I had pneumonia.
So I appreciate the effort that you put into this. Should we call on your
my helpers here are going to help me go through the bill
very well
with you, explain the different areas of the bill so that you're very clear.
And again, we have about 10 minutes left. You don't feel like you need to rush through the bill. We'll just pick it up where we leave off tomorrow morning. So, Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chairman, members, just to preface a couple things. Mr. Piccolo and I are going to try to kind of tag team on this. The underlying bill, House File 935, was the department's bill, and then the delete everything amendment includes a number of provisions that Max has brought forward and that they're proposing and championing. So I'll certainly let Mr. Piccolo address those. Since we've talked about the OLA report a lot, as I go through the language, I'll try to highlight where there's specific language that relates to the OLA recommendations. And the last thing I'll say, when you referenced this early, Mr. Chairman, you'll see throughout the bill, we've changed everywhere in the bill where the word sponsor appears, changed it to authorizer, and just a word about why that is. Minnesota is actually one of only, I think, three states out of the 40 states in the District of Columbia that have a charter school law that use the term sponsor. Everyone else uses the term authorizer. And there was a joint feeling among all the folks involved in this bill that as we're trying to clarify and strengthen the purpose of authorizers, that using the term sponsor was misleading because sponsor implies financial support, or the various definitions for sponsor really are different from the definition of an authorizer, which really implies oversight to us and strengthened oversight. So I just wanted to, you'll see that throughout the bill. Starting with subdivision one, there's some minor changes there that really just clarify and hopefully strengthen the purposes for which the charter school bill exists and for charter schools to operate. Under subdivision 2A, which is the Charter School Advisory Council, the bill is proposing that the Charter School Advisory Council be reestablished. It sunsetted, I believe, in 2007, and so it's being reestablished here. And some of the language is being changed, you'll see going over onto page 2, to reflect the new paradigm, a new system we're going to have with the OLA recommendations, with a lot more focus on the department approving authorizers and strengthening oversight of authorizers. So that's why some of that new language is in there about the council's responsibilities, but it essentially would be an advisory council to the commissioner.
Mr. Brown,
yes.
And we've had some talk about commissions, and I suspect Representative Gravling would be interested in this issue, you know, because commissions tend to cost money, and, you know, we're not necessarily in a posture of spending new, more money this session. But that aside, it's an important issue. What is the importance of the commission relative
right.
to the reform efforts that are being attempted here?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Two things. One, to clarify that this council structure does not have a cost, and you'll see specifically where we go back. It looks minor, but if you go back to line 1.21, the original council, which is being reestablished, was established under section 15.059, which is what gives the council members the right to have per diems and travel costs reimbursed, and we're not including that here. So there will not be, the council members will be volunteering out of their good faith. They won't be eligible for any of those kind of reimbursements. But in addition, I think even with the previous council, and I think this is a much more sharply focused council, it really is important for the commissioner to have a sounding board, especially as we're establishing some of these new provisions, like a process for approving authorizers, which frankly very few states do, where the department actually approves the authorizers before they can start authorizing charter schools. That we're going to want folks from a broad range of kind of the charter school community and education community to give the commissioner feedback as we design those kind of new structures and systems.
And, you know, perhaps let me just do this. We are going to run out here in a little under 5 minutes. Perhaps we can just entertain some discussion around the, we just scratched the surface,
yeah.
but around the council itself, and then we'll pick up the rest of the bill tomorrow. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, why did the council get expired in 2007? I think that was the governor's recommendation, wasn't it? And then why is it being what has changed that it's now useful?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Growling, my understanding, although I apologize because I wasn't here in 2007, is that there was an attempt to continue it, and that didn't come to pass that session. But I think for whatever reason that it did sunset, the feeling was this time by everyone that given that in some ways this really is the biggest rewrite of the charter school law since its enactment in 1991, and given that we're going to be changing a lot of paradigms, putting some new systems in place for increased accountability, that the commissioner really wanted to have this kind of group available to give her feedback on an ongoing basis.
Well, Mr. Chair, we have like the stakeholders group that we use for testing. Is that in statute? And if it is.
No,
Madam Chair, Representative Grinling, no, it's not, but it's a requirement of No Child Left Behind.
And Mr. Brown, without this group wouldn't exist then?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grinling, I assume the Commissioner, of course, always has authority to form various working groups, advisory panels on her own. The question was whether the assumption was that the legislature would want to have a say in the makeup of that council in terms of the types of people who would be appointed to the council and the purposes of the council. So rather than the Commissioner just having the Commissioner go off and do it on own, it was kept to say, this existed before under legislative statute, and we want the legislator's input before she was to set it up again.
To the Assistant Commissioner, I find it interesting that you just delete a certain 15.059 and the cost goes away. When legislators do that, the department comes back like with the Early Childhood Advisory Council and said it's a minimum of $25,000. So I just hope you'll remember that, and it's probably not gone away. Also, there's money in federal stimulus money for councils, and I think you all know that. There's a matching requirement to that. I think it's a 50% match, maybe. But just some ideas is there is stimulus money for this as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, and I want to make clear, if the department's budget allowed, which it doesn't appear like it's going to now, currently or in the future, if there was money available, the commissioner could choose to provide some minimal kinds of reimbursement for members if she so chose in terms of travel or mileage or what have you. What this does is remove the mandate that we would have to, if the council itself decided to provide per diems for members, reimburse travel, lodging, that type of thing, that then the department would be obligated to, and that's what would generate a fiscal cost in our budget.
Just a quick follow-up, but some council, we can just decide you're not going to have per diems, and the department never offered that as an option on the early childhood. We can talk more about it, but interesting.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there was another council that was created by the legislature, was the Online Learning Advisory Council, which sunsetted last year, which was created in a similar way. When the legislature created it, it did not, it was not under 15059, and we didn't have a budget for the Online Learning Advisory Council, so we really couldn't allow the council to just go ahead and authorize its own per diem. We did when we had budget available, try to reimburse them for some mileage, particularly the folks coming from out state. But when it's printed 15059, it's the council that retains the authority to decide what kind of per diems they get, and then the department's obligated to pay it and find the money. And we just, given the budget situation, we didn't want to put ourselves in that situation with this council.
Representative, I've had that experience with the department in the past, so it took the 15.059. Ms. Barnett, welcome to the committee. I think your first appearance here. You're with the department. I guess you have something to add to this.
Yes, you don't mind.
You'll have to use the mic.
Yes.
State your name for the record.
Excuse me, Chair. My name is Lisa Barnes. I'm also with the Department of Education. And I did just want to note for this council as in comparison to perhaps a new council that would be proposed in statute, this is a council that has already been in existence, so the department has already kind of taken those costs within our own costs so far, but as Morgan was saying, with new councils and with the current budget, the staff costs that we do have that we currently are just taking within our current budget, we're no longer able to just take on those extra costs. So that's one reason why if a new council were to be given to us, we do cost out those. Also to the point that Morgan was saying, by deleting that one section, it does allow us to not have to pay those per diems for the council's members, which is a cost that at this point, again, we also cannot just take on in our current budget.
And members, Representative Grinling, assuming the bill successfully moves through here to Representative Grinling's committee, I'm sure she will vet this out much more carefully there, so we don't need to We can certainly do that, but we don't need to do that at this point.
Mr. Chairman, I just note one thing that I wanted to. When we were going through this bill, we were very conscious to make it a pure policy bill and not have any costs in here. So if those questions come up about other provisions, I'm happy to talk about how we try to make sure there was not a cost factor to the provisions of this bill.
I appreciate that. Members, we do have a couple of other questions, but we will keep them in mind for our next hearing. We are done for today. We're past the time limit a few minutes. I look forward to a good discussion tomorrow. Until tomorrow morning, this committee stands.